It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Protesters gathered Sunday outside the walls of Wisconsin's maximum security prison. They held signs displaying the names of four inmates who have died at Waupun Correctional Institution since June of 2023, including Dean Hoffman. His daughter, Megan Hoffman Kolb, spoke to the crowd.
It has been 466 days since this lockdown began at Waupun Correctional Facility. It's been 426 days since my dad arrived here. It's been 346 days since my dad died here.
The former warden and eight other employees have been criminally charged with the deaths of two inmates, Donald Meyer and Cameron Williams. We'll be joined by Republican State Representative Mark Bourne to talk about potential legislative action toward Wisconsin's Department of Corrections. Now let's get up to speed on developments with WPR reporter Sarah Lear. Sarah, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
So how unusual is it to charge prison staff with crimes?
Experts I talked to said it's pretty unusual nationwide. In Wisconsin, some of the current and former staff members who are charged are facing charges under a decades-old state law that makes it a felony for a prison employee to abuse or mistreat an inmate. And we know because of statewide court data that that charge has been used in about 11 other cases, not counting the Waupun case, over about a five-year period. So it's a charge that is used in Wisconsin, but not that frequently.
Now, when announcing the arrests, Sheriff Dale Schmidt blamed overcrowding, understaffing, and inadequate training for the conditions at Waupun. What can you tell us about these criminal charges and the death of 62-year-old Donald Meyer and 24-year-old Cameron Williams?
All of the charges are felonies. A total of nine current and former staffers are facing charges, including the former warden, Randy Hepp, who submitted his resignation at the end of May. The death of Donald Meyer was caused by dehydration and malnutrition. Prosecutors say that staff shut off water to his cell. Staff members said he might have tried to flood the cell earlier and that staff failed to bring him meals. The other death that resulted in charges, the death of Cameron Williams, was caused by a stroke, and prosecutors say that staff there ignored signs of medical distress, didn't perform required checks, and that it appears that Williams wasn't found dead until at least 12 hours after he had died.
What stands out to me here, too, is that it's not just correctional officers who are charged. It's two nurses as well. What do you know more there about the assembly of people here in these charges?
So we do have corrections officers, some supervisors, some's not. The former warden, Randy Hepp, and two nurses. The Department of Corrections hasn't released details on what exactly the employment status is of each individual person, but they said everyone who's facing criminal charges is either no longer employed by the department or on unpaid administrative leave. The department says those employees are also providing their own legal representation.
And then earlier this month, former Corrections Department Secretary Kevin Carr announces his retirement. Governor Tony Evers appointed Jared Hoy as a replacement. What are Hoy's plans for the department? What has been said there?
So Jared Hoy is an internal hire. He was previously the deputy secretary at the Department of Corrections. He's been with Wisconsin's department since, I believe, 2007. He has announced some additional security measures. And it's worth noting that Waupun has been under what's known as lockdown status since spring of last year.
We heard the 466 days
yes.
at the top. What does that lockdown mean?
So department staff have cited security concerns and they've been restricting the movement of inmates. You know, when the lockdown began, they were largely confined to their cells. They were getting one shower per week. Staff say they've since been easing some of that restrictions and that process began before Hoy started. But at Waupun, inmates there still face limits on their weekly recreation time and they're barred from in-person visits. However, the department did say in its latest status report that they hope to allow outsiders to visit in person later this summer at Waupun.
And then finally, there is the Federal Department of Justice involved in investigating a smuggling conspiracy at Waupun. Where is that investigation now?
That investigation is ongoing, and the sheriff whose office investigated the deaths at Waupun had made clear that that investigation into the smuggling of illegal contraband and also possible financial crimes is separate from his investigation into the deaths.
Thank you so much, Sarah, for this update.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Lear is a WPR reporter following developments at Waupun Correctional Institution. And joining us now to talk about the future of this prison is Mark Bourne, Republican state representative from Beaver Dam. Representative Bourne, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
You say you are working with State Representative Michael Schraw on a bill that would create more transparency, more accountability in state correctional facilities. What do you envision with this legislation?
Well, what we're taking a look at right now and hoping to do is to develop something similar to what we have currently on the books for the oversight of county jails, where there is a department within the Department of Corrections that is the jail inspector that goes through county jails routinely and make sure that they're complying with policies, procedures, state law, federal law, writes reports on those, identifying the good, the bad, whatever the case might be. And so we're looking at trying to develop something like that for our state prison system. Obviously, it can't be exactly the same. I don't think it makes sense to put another office within DOC to look at themselves. So we're kind of looking at options now on the best way to do that. But I think it's clear that more oversight is needed and more accountability, certainly with these charges that have been brought forward. We're very concerned that from the top down, the management is allowing these type of things to occur. There's something that made these individuals who were charged think that they could get away with it, or that it was okay, or that the accountability to make sure they were following policies and procedures and the law in some cases was not necessary. And so that's a real concern. We certainly don't believe that it's happening in all of our correctional facilities. We know there are a lot of good staff doing the right thing, doing good jobs to help keep our community safe. But the fact that this occurred and to the extent that it occurred and led to some very tragic outcomes, we just think there's more accountability that's needed. So that's why we're exploring this, and we're kind of modeling it after the something that we already have in place that helps keep that accountability at our county-run facilities.
I would imagine this type of inspection would allow these facilities to make corrective action before laws would perhaps be broken.
That's probably the best part about it. You know, certainly before I came into the legislature, I worked for the Dodge County Sheriff's Department in that corrections division. I'm very familiar with both corrections and the inspections that took place. And oftentimes the inspections didn't find major problems because things were, you know, being run appropriately. But when they did identify something, it was a chance to improve, a chance to change a policy, change the way we were training something to make sure that things were running the best they could to be in compliance with policy and the law, and also for safety of everyone. It's just as important for the safety to be in place for the staff as it is for the folks that are housed in these facilities. And we really viewed those inspections as an opportunity.
Let's talk about the safety of these buildings themselves. Parts of Waupun Correctional Institution built in the 1800s, Civil War era. Consultants in 2019 said replacing a century-old prison near Green Bay would cost $500 million. Should the state replace these facilities with new prisons?
There's no doubt it's very expensive to replace these facilities, but it's also very expensive to run them. They're not designed to be run by today's standards. Now, it doesn't mean they can't be run safely. They can be. It just means it costs a lot more to do that, especially with staffing costs. We have to staff these prisons with a lot more people, which is, of course, challenging right now with workforce being a challenge everywhere. But that's the way to run these safely, is with higher costs and more staffing. So while the price tag would be big to build it, there would be cost savings over time. It would be safer to run with fewer people. And so that's really the discussion, where the discussion I think should be. Certainly as a co-chair of the budget committee, that's one of my focuses, is how can we run safe facilities that are safe for everyone, the folks working there and being required to live there, keep those constitutional protections in place, and do it in the most cost-effective way. And the fact is, it's just hard to run these old prisons. And so while that's not what led to these problems by themselves, they certainly bring challenges. And in the case of, you know, staffing challenges right now, with, like I said, workforce challenges everywhere, it's difficult to fill these positions. And I know there's been great improvements since we made major investments in the last budget, but it's still a challenge with staffing.
I want to talk with you about that challenge. We've heard lockdowns for hundreds of days at Waupun, the state raising wages for corrections officers to $33 per hour last summer. Is that enough to address staffing shortages at these state prisons?
Well, right now the numbers appear like it's having a very positive effect. In most other facilities, the numbers have come down quite a bit. The recruit classes have been very large. So it's certainly having the desired effect. But whether or not it's enough to do it alone, you know, only time will tell. And part of that is because of the workforce challenges everywhere. There's only so many folks in the market for any kind of a job right now. And that's part of why the discussion should be, if we build a modern facility, you can safely staff it with fewer people. And that, you know, coupled with these major increases in wages, can certainly be part of the solution long term.
A modern facility, I'm wondering, you know, Wisconsin Policy Forum says Wisconsin has one of the highest incarceration rates in the Midwest. Beyond a facility, should the state be lowering its prison population? In our last moments together,
there's certainly things that we can look at to do that, but you got to remember that, well, the prisons we're talking about here in Waupun and Green Bay are maximum security facilities. We're never going to have, you know, no need for maximum security prisons. These are our worst offenders. Mm. So, you know, folks that you might be releasing sooner or earlier, or earned release and things like that, are going to be in your minimum and medium facilities. So population could change there, but we're certainly going to have a maximum security need in the future.
Representative Bourne, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Bourne is a Republican state representative from Beaver Dam. He co-chairs the legislature's Joint Finance Committee. And earlier, we talked with WPR reporter Sarah Lear.
Coming up, a major healthcare system in Wisconsin was hit by a cyber attack. It took a month to get everything back online.
That could have affected a decision between life and death.
Get a first-hand look at what the attacks meant for hospital staff and patient safety. That's next on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Early last month, the healthcare organization Ascension announced that it was the target of a large-scale ransomware attack hitting around 140 hospitals and even more clinics around the country.
The attack left healthcare facilities without access to online records and systems for weeks. The healthcare system has 17 hospitals here in Wisconsin.
In a statement yesterday, Ascension says most record systems are back online in Wisconsin, but especially in the early days of the attack, the loss of electronic records had a big impact on providers and patients.
Connie Smith is with us for a firsthand account. She's president of the Wisconsin Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals, and she's a charge capture coordinator at Ascension St. Francis in Milwaukee, one of the hospitals affected by the attack. Connie, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it, Rob.
All right, it's been about a month now since this ransomware attack first started. Ascension St. Francis, one of the affected hospitals. Take us back to that. What effect did this have on you and your colleagues?
So, you know, like you said, it was a month ago. It's been a long time. And I think emotionally, when people leave work, they are tired and stressed out to a point of almost the feeling people felt leaving work after COVID. like mentally and physically. This is something new for a lot of our nurses. They've never paper charted at all. And even with the papers being similar, it's really something that's been tough on a lot of us because our paper charting was nowhere near what it needed to be for this extensive time of being down.
Yeah, it's really easy for me to say, oh, okay, computer's down, you switch to paper. I'm guessing it's a whole heck of a lot harder in practice in the moment to suddenly completely change the way you're dealing with every patient's record, right?
100%. It has been a tough challenge from our outpatient departments to our inpatient departments, you know, our emergency rooms, even down to our cleaning staff and our kitchen workers. The way we use, you know, the electronic record to get people dinner and lunch and breakfast and to get our rooms, you know, tidied up and or cleaned after somebody has left, all goes through that medical record.
Are there departments that were particularly affected by last month's cyber attack? Who took the biggest brunt of it?
Department-wise, I think outpatient might have took a bigger hit to people coming in and going because orders come in through that electronic record to get an X-ray or an order comes through for just a outpatient surgery or an order comes through for an MRI. And those orders were no longer able to be dropped over. And so the patients and or the staff in other like clinics were physically having to carry the orders over or go pick their orders up and bring them with you. Because even the majority of our fax machines were hooked up through the electronic type of record. I think we had one dial-up machine in the whole hospital. So all of a sudden, they were like, can we use yours? Can we use yours? So it's been a lot of work for everybody.
If I was a patient, especially during those early days, it sounds like, A, I would have been carrying my records maybe from one office to another. What other things might patients have seen?
I think patients seen a longer wait time for some things initially in the first couple days and maybe that first week or two. I think they've also noticed how something as simple as the wristband that they would have gotten, you know, at the beginning of the year versus the wristband they got at this time of the year were totally different. So when you were scanned to get your medicine, they couldn't do that anymore. So patients are noticing that, especially those that were already inpatient.
Was there any worry that patients might hear this news and postpone or just skip a treatment they might have otherwise needed to receive, thinking, okay, maybe I'll wait till this all sorts itself out?
Yeah, I think there was some worry with that initially. Like, are these patients going to show up for their procedure knowing that they didn't get their record or we didn't have their record or we would have patients that showed up, but would have to wait because within the first couple of days, we had to go back and get all kinds of orders that were initially there and they were no longer available for us to see.
At least two class action lawsuits have been filed, I understand, against Ascension following the cyber attack, alleging that the company failed to safeguard protected health information. Are there things you'd like to see Ascension change to be ready, God forbid, for the next ransomware attack?
Oh, 100%. There is so much Ascension could have done better in this. Communication with staff could have been a lot better. We didn't hear stuff for days. We were using forms that were we pulled out of like drawers that hadn't seen the light of day in a long, long time. But I think communication 100% would have helped. But the reality behind it is we need staff. And we needed staff before this, and we need staff now. And not just at St. Francis, but nationally.
And they have been so slim and cutting back on the number of people that are in the facilities, and the time that they are taking to replace somebody has been so long. It's just one more set of hands on that first day could have changed what is happening across the board.
Now, Connie, the perpetrators of this ransomware attack could literally be anywhere on the planet. Odds are they're not listening to our Wisconsin show. If you had a chance to send a message to them about the damage they've done, the impact they've had on people, what would you say to them?
This was life. We couldn't see EKGs. We didn't have access to, you know, people's different types of medicines and past results. And that could have affected a decision between life and death. This isn't people's addresses and stuff. When you get into things like this, this could have affected many, many, many people across so many states of the difference between getting the right medicine and not having the right medicine. What if it was you that was, you know, trying to get that med?
Connie, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
You are so welcome. Thank you.
That was Connie Smith, Charge Capture Coordinator at Ascension St. Francis in Milwaukee, President of the Wisconsin Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals. The Ascension attack is just the latest in a growing list of ransomware and other cyber criminal attacks targeting healthcare facilities. Hannah Nieprasch studies the impact of those attacks. Hannah is a health economist and assistant professor at the University of Minnesota. She's co-author of a paper titled Hacked to Pieces: The Effect of Ransomware Attacks on Hospitals and Patients. Hannah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we've got this news here in Wisconsin, this cyber attack on the healthcare system, Ascension, leaving hospitals around the country, across Wisconsin, without access to a lot of key computer-based stuff. How does this Ascension cyber attack compare to others that you've looked into the impact of?
It's a good question, and in many ways, I think the Ascension attack is pretty emblematic of how cyber attacks happen in healthcare and how they disrupt the delivery of care. Ascension's electronic health records are down, which is probably the single most common disruption that my team has observed when we looked across nearly 400 ransomware attacks in healthcare. The other thing is it's not uncommon to see cyber attacks cause these disruptions for multiple weeks. You know, we're almost a month into the Ascension attack, and as terrible as that is, it's not that unusual.
You and your colleagues have written that there are a lot of things that make the healthcare sector a, I'm going to quote here, hacker's playground. What makes health systems particularly vulnerable to these kind of attacks?
Oh, where do I start? So first off, we, you know, about a decade, maybe 15 years ago, we really dragged healthcare kicking and screaming into the 21st century. And now we're here and everybody is hooked on the electronic health record. And it's not just that. There are all these systems that talk to each other in healthcare that are crucial to delivering care, whether it's sending a prescription from a doctor's office to a pharmacy or looking up what medications somebody's allergic to, or finding somebody's, you know, CT scan and seeing what their lab results might be. All of this stuff is electronic now, and it is crucial to the delivery of care. But most clinicians, whether they're nurses or doctors, they're not experts in the electronics. They're experts in the medicine. So they're not necessarily thinking first and foremost about preventing cyber attacks. So it's this combination of really important electronic systems and people who are really distracted by trying to keep their patients alive and healthy. So they're just not on the lookout for the cyber threats.
You have found that ransomware attacks can impact the number of patients who die in a hospital during a cyber attack. That's a big deal. What did you find?
This is the part of the research that I think keeps me up at night most. We found evidence that patients are more likely to die in the hospital during a ransomware attack mortality goes up by about 1 to 2 percentage points. It doesn't sound like much, but it's already a pretty rare outcome. So another way to say this is, if you are a patient who has the misfortune to be admitted to the hospital, when that hospital gets hit by a ransomware attack, the chances that you walk out the door alive go down slightly, but significantly.
That's the big worry, of course, is impact on patients. There's also a revenue impact on hospitals. And we've seen here in Wisconsin, it's not guaranteed that hospitals stay open forever. We've seen some hospitals and clinics close because the bottom line just doesn't add up. How big an impact do ransomware attacks have on that bottom line?
Ransomware attacks are terrible for the financial health of hospitals. We see about a 20 to 40% decline in revenue. A lot of that is because they're admitting fewer patients. They're treating fewer patients in the emergency room. And the patients that they do treat are less likely to get some of those complicated imaging services. And what that means is that a 3-week long attack, that's kind of the average ransomware attack, reduces hospital revenue by about 1% per year. So it's a huge hit to the bottom line for these hospitals.
And speaking of bottom line, lawsuits then follow. We know of at least 2 class action lawsuits in just this Ascension attack. Now, the suits allege that the company failed to safeguard this important health information. I've seen some finger pointing saying, hold on, it should be the software provider. No, it is the health system. Who do we hold accountable? Apart from, of course, the criminals themselves, who do we hold accountable when this happens?
I wish I knew the right answer to that. Mm-hmm. But it just the fact that we're asking that question gets at some of this complexity and all the interconnectedness in healthcare. The fact that we don't know who is in charge of keeping that information safe shows us why healthcare is so vulnerable. But you're right, there's increasing legal action. And that's another thing that really adds to the cost of cyber attacks, because it just raises more legal costs for the hospitals that go through these attacks.
Looking to future prevention. Now, you mentioned that, the doctors and nurses and technicians, they're not cybersecurity experts. And for me as a patient, that's okay. I don't want them worried about cybersecurity. I want them, looking at my symptoms and what's causing them and things like that. Who needs to take the lead, though, to make sure that there is cybersecurity, that there's less risk of these attacks happening and better recovery when they do happen?
So for me, this is the silver lining. There are so many examples of, what I think of as low-hanging fruit in terms of improvements that can be made to cybersecurity in healthcare. And you're right, the doctors, the nurses, they're not the cybersecurity experts, but most of these large health systems employ information security teams. And those folks do stuff like email security protocols, multi-factor authentication, stronger encryption, basic cybersecurity training for clinical staff. All these things are part of recommendations that the Department of Health and Human Services at the federal level, recommendations they've put forward as basic cybersecurity performance goals for every hospital and health system around the country to implement, ideally as soon as possible.
How about redundancy in systems? Because the actual nature of these cyber attacks, key information is stolen or encrypted so that now the hospital staff can't get access to it. Are there backup systems in place, redundant systems where we could say, okay, the A data is locked up here, let's turn on plan B and hopefully be able to do that faster than the weeks and months it seems to take?
Exactly. That's a big recommendation. The one thing I would say on that is that it's not enough to just have the backups. You have to train the clinical staff in, how to engage those downtime protocols and what it really means to switch to pen and paper and where you can get at some of that backed up data.
I could see somebody hearing all this and saying, hang on. Given the risk of ransomware attacks or other cyber crimes, were we better off the old way where it was pen and paper? I'm guessing there's a cost-benefit trade-off here. I'm guessing, I don't know. My guess would be, yes, it's still been worth it. What do you think?
I think so, too. And, you know, you're talking like an economist now in terms of trade-offs. Everything always has an upside and a downside. And I think we're better off in the digital age. But this is definitely an unintended consequence, I would say, of switching, relying so heavily on electronic systems.
As we move on, hopefully soon past this Ascension attack, what is the big story for you? What do you have your eye on when it comes to the future of cybersecurity in hospital and healthcare settings?
Yeah, I'm really interested to see how policy evolves. Right now, every hospital in the country has a lot of discretion over how much they spend on cybersecurity and what they do to invest in more resilient systems. And I think that we're going to see some standardization to try to prevent, these really big attacks like the Ascension attack.
Hannah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Hannah Neeprash is a health economist and assistant professor at the University of Minnesota. We also heard from Connie Smith, healthcare worker at Ascension St. Francis in Milwaukee. A spokesperson for Ascension confirmed yesterday that Ascension Wisconsin has successfully restored almost all electronic health record and service access over the weekend. In response to the two class action lawsuits that have been filed against Ascension, a spokesperson for the health company said they are investigating the incident. They say if sensitive data was taken or accessed, they'll notify and support the affected individuals in accordance with all relevant regulatory and legal obligations.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, meet two Wisconsin performers who train people in circus arts.
In the midst of all of the juggling and balancing skills and things like that, everybody will find something. They'll learn how to balance a feather, or some skill will speak to them.
That's coming up here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin has a long history of celebrating the circus. The Ringling Brothers got their start in Baraboo, and P.T. Barnum started his circus in Delavan.
Fast forward 150 years, and aerial arts are still practiced across the state by performers of all ages, with circus spaces offering training everywhere from Bloomer to Milwaukee.
We are swinging, flipping, and dancing our way into Wisconsin's circus arts community with two performers and trainers.
Jacob Mills is a performer and co-founder of the Wild Rumpus Circus at Mesa Maney, and Mandy Marchal is host and show director for Dark Arts Circus in Green Bay and a co-owner of Fly Circus and Aerial Arts in Appleton. Mandy, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Jacob, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure.
Okay. Now, the circus arts, that covers a lot of ground. Jacob, what kind of things are you doing at your space in Mesa Maney?
We do a whole range of things. We do all of the aerial arts. We do stilts is a very huge part of our camp. Clowning, mime, theater, tumbling. What am I forgetting? A little bit of everything. Stilts is a huge part of our camp. In the course of a week, even our youngest campers generally will be free of a helping hand and be walking on their own on stilts. We try to create an atmosphere where everybody has a place in our circus camp. Not everyone is supposed to be a great circus performer when they leave, but as I like to say, they'll make board meetings more interesting.
And Mandy, in Appleton, what kinds of things are you specializing in there?
Yeah,
So at Fly Circus in Appleton, we place a lot of emphasis on the aerial arts. So that's kind of the core of our programming. We teach silks, hammock, lyra, or the aerial hoop. We also have pole classes, as well as trapeze. We don't have the height or the room to do flying trapeze, so we do kind of like dance trapeze, as well as incorporating some acrobatics. That's very popular amongst our students. As well as flow arts, so things like silk fan, poi, things like that.
Jacob, you're based in Mazamani. How has that small community embraced Wild Rumpus Circus?
Well, you know, Mazamani is the entertainment capital of the world. Most people know that. And what a lot of people don't know is the link with Mazamani to the circus is that when the Ringling Brothers were boys and had been doing shows in their friends' backyards in Baraboo, they decided to see what would happen if they went to another town. And so they had a horse and a wagon, and they came down to Mazamani, and they rented the upstairs hall across the street from our building, and they put on a show. The story was that the show was terrible, but then the rest was history. But the show itself was not really a circus as much as it was vaudeville and song and dance and stuff like that. There weren't any animals in the show. I think that I'd be honest and have to say that the majority of our students come from Madison and the surrounding areas. We're a small community, and we have a bus service that picks the kids up in Madison on the east and the west side and brings them out here. So that makes it easy. But in terms of the people, you know, we're still an oddity here in town after being here for 23 years, and introducing people to it, it has been a process. But they love it because once camp season gets started, then there's people, kids on stilts going up and down the street. And we usually do some sort of a presentation. Last couple of years, we do a thing on the Thursday before the last day of the week-long circuses. We talk about busking and passing the hat, and we advertise that we're doing it. And the kids all go out onto the street, and we actually do it on the sidewalk, and we put hats out. And the kids just, depending on their level, do what they can. We raised $1,000 and gave it to the food bank this last year. So it became really a fun thing to do. And the kids get a big kick out of it. And tourists, you know, they come spinning through trying to figure out what is there to do in Mazo. And then they run across that on the corner. And sometimes they go around the block twice, and then they slow down and have some money and drop it in the kids' hats and stuff like that.
And Mandy, your groups are based in, you're based in Appleton, but you're drawing from the Fox Cities and Green Bay. What kind of community support are you getting?
Yeah, the community has really been super supportive. I like to say the Fox Valley and Green Bay are kind of going through still a bit of an artistic renaissance. We're really seeing a lot more focus and encouragement from the city, even hiring us to come and perform at different events, encouraging people to come and see us. So it's been really, really motivating, really refreshing. We are, oh my gosh, our classes are fuller than ever. We are seeing more new students than ever. Folks are still kind of finding out about us, I think, in our community. But the interest is definitely there. And I have to say that is really exciting.
We're talking about the circus arts in Wisconsin with two instructors and performers here in the state. Jacob Mills is co-founder of Wild Rumpus Circus in Mazamani, and Mandy Martzel is co-owner of Fly Circus and Aerial Arts in Appleton. Mandy, I know both of you work with kids, I think, but suppose you had an adult who wanted to learn to do something cool along these lines, but they're a little clumsy, uncoordinated. They have a sedentary job, like, I don't know, radio talking guy or something like that. What, Mandy, would you start somebody like that at?
That I think anybody can make their way into the circus arts or aerial arts.
It's you haven't seen me dance.
I bet it's amazing. I bet you have more moves than you think you do. And I think that's really true with all people, truly, even if we are working in these sedentary jobs, like you still have a few muscles in there. So what we like to do at Fly Circus is just kind of get a better idea, get to know our new flyer a little bit better. To get a better idea of what they're interested in and where they would like to see themselves and start them off on the apparatuses. We can absolutely get you day one into the fabric, into the hoop, and doing something pretty cool. Folks definitely surprise themselves with what they're capable of. And that's what's really cool about this art. It's not competitive, right? We don't play on teams or anything like that. It's just you working on yourself and pushing yourself to your next goal.
And Jacob, whether we're talking about the high-flying stuff or the mime you were talking about earlier, whatever the case, can you talk about the value of embracing this this creative side that also, you know, it harnesses our physical sides?
Well, the thing with kids and is that these kinds of things, they don't realize how much exercise is involved. You know, they think of exercise as being more formal, whereas when you come to circus camp, you know, we do a big warm-up. We might do a number of warm-ups during the day, depending on what apparatus we're going to work on or whether we're waking up or whether we're getting ready to do some improv or whatever we're going to do. Everybody does it differently, you know. That's everybody gets things differently. So one person might do really good aerial stuff. That might be something that really talks to them because they've done some gymnastics or they've done some dance. Whereas that might not be the case with other people. And the thing that's great about circus is and circus camp is that they're getting exposed to just a whole bunch of stuff. And usually in the midst of all the juggling and balancing skills and things like that, everybody will find something. They'll learn how to balance a feather or some skill will speak to them. And it's probably a skill that they had not even imagined. Their idea of juggling was just juggling balls or the more traditional things. But they might figure out how to do a Diablo or a devil stick or something like that. And it's perfectly okay, you know.
Mandy, is there something when, you know, kids are taking classes, is there something where this is a crowd pleaser, like all the kids want to do blank? What would that be?
Ooh, right now, I would say all the kids want to do hammock, which is so interesting. I think
a
couple years ago.
Like, I like laying in a hammock, but I'm guessing it's not just that. What is hammock?
A little different. Yes, a little different. So the aerial hammock is a fabric apparatus. It's like a giant fabric loop hanging from the ceiling. So you're kind of supported and you can do some really cool tricks in there. The kids are just crazy about it right now. That is so popular. A few years ago, they were really into the lira or the aerial hoop. I'm always kind of curious, and I wonder if it's just me being out of, like, the cultural zeitgeist, if there's, like, a pop star or something. I know Pink is very big using aerial arts in her tours right now, but if there are other artists maybe kind of promoting that, because kids find it on YouTube. They see these things, and they're like, I want to do this, and then they task their parents with finding a teacher for it, so it's pretty interesting.
And Jacob, what's a crowd pleaser for Wild Rumpus?
Well, I think aerial always is a club. All of the aerial stuff is, but stilts is, by about the third day of a 5-day camp, they're up and we're teaching them how to do the hustle. And what happens is in that time, the first time that somebody's friend takes off with nobody holding on to him, all of a sudden, all those people that were having trouble, that trouble clears up. Because they want to do it too, and they get focused right away. And it's rare that we'll get at the end of even a 5-day camp and everybody isn't up and moving around. And in most cases, when the weather's nice, we go right outside. Now, we'll go down. We'll go all the way down to the school, to the playground, and back. And they really get some trucking on their stilts. And then what happens later is when we get asked to come to a parade or some sort of event, we do a lot of stuff with Madison's Children's Museum, fantastic place. We'll invite them too. We call it a tall call. And we'll bring 25 stilt walkers to a parade and dress them all out in costumes. And that is also a very fun thing for a young performer, because it's a one trick pony. You know, you're moving the whole time. So you have these new audience to either be entertaining or try to engage with them and look like you're having a great time at the same time.
Just briefly, I want to ask each of you, we focused on, you know, teaching kids for the most part, but make the case for somebody going out and checking out a show of people doing the kind of performances you do. Mandy, what are we missing if we don't go see some of these different circus arts in person?
Oh my gosh, you're missing so many things. I like to use my dark art shows as an example. We really operate on a variety show model. That was super important to me when I started this, was to be able to feature as many different performing styles as possible, as many apparatuses, props, what have you. So at one of my shows, you can expect to see a flow artist doing who knows what with all sorts of implements. Fire is a big one. Fire is a huge one. We always like to incorporate the fire. That's a big crowd pleaser. Fire breathers, fire eaters, fire dancers. Aerial arts, of course, that is always so amazing. Again, as many different props and apparatuses as we possibly can, getting them up on stage. And then we also like to incorporate some drag artists into the mix, or even some burlesque performers. And also sideshow, of course. That is my personal favorite little niche of the circus world. So we like to get that in there as well.
And Jacob, leave us a shill for us like the old time circus and carnival hawkers might. Why should we go check out a circus arts show?
In our shows, you'll see tight wire, you'll see silks, you'll see trapeze, you'll see masks, you'll see clowns, music, stilts. We had an all-stilt marching band in this last fall, you know, this last March show. But a sense of improvisation at the same time, which is certainly part of a real circus show, is the idea that there is no line between the circus performers and the audience. The clowns are just as likely to come into the audience. The ringmaster is just as likely to talk to you. And so the element of improvisation, whether it's in a form of comedy or in a routine, is always there. Expect the unexpected. And usually there's always some things that no one has ever seen before. In our winter show, as we call it. We also do, we have what we call tour camp. And tour camp is a 2 week long camp. The kids are sort of the ones that have been with us the most. They write the show. We sort of help direct it and mold it. We do a rehearsal in Mazo, and then we go to Viroqua. And there's a small program there of aerial stuff, and we try to integrate if we can with them. And we do a show in a park in Viroqua, and it's a beautiful place for a show. It's grassy and stuff. And there we can do fire, but most of the time fire isn't – we can't use fire in a theater, but that's sort of what our summer is like.
We'll leave it there. Jacob, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely. My pleasure.
And Mandy, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. It was great to be here.
Jacob Mills is a performer, co-founder of the Wild Rumpus Circus in Mazamani, and Mandy Martel is host and show director for Dark Arts Circus in Green Bay and co-owner of Fly Circus and Aerial Arts in Appleton.
If you are dealing with seasonal allergies, this will come as no surprise. Most of Wisconsin is seeing pretty solid pollen counts lately, with ratings from moderate to very high for grass and tree pollen. And here at Wisconsin Today, we have a canary in the allergy coal mine. someone by the name of Rob Ferret.
Yeah, I got tested for pollen allergies when I was a kid. It came back all of the above. I got grasses, got trees, I got the ragweeds.
So give us a reading. How are things this year?
I feel like they're pretty bad. Like, my head is always puffy. I feel like you should just be able to see that my head is even, you know, bigger than usual. Plus the itchy eyes, the sneezing, all the stuff.
We want to hear your allergy report. How are things for you? Does it seem worse than usual this year? Do you have a magic cure? Call now at 888-642-0232. You can send along an email to wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
And we can share your reports here on Wisconsin Today. Plus, you'll let me know that I'm not alone here. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.